May it please the court, James Hardy, attorney number 38173 for the appellant Karen Leslie. I intend to save approximately 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal today. This case is about an invalid and involuntary waiver of the right to counsel. Ms. Leslie was deprived of her right to counsel below when she requested substitute counsel and the trial court denied her request without any inquiry into the reasons for it and forced Ms. Leslie to represent herself at trial unwillingly. This constitutes structural error, and Ms. Leslie requests that this court reverse her convictions and remand this case for a new trial. I intend to focus my remarks today on the four-part test in People v. Bergerud, and to focus on how the record here demonstrates Ms. Leslie had good cause for her request for substitute counsel below. Secondly, I'd like to address what the proper remedy is for this court today. Under People v. Bergerud, the first prong of that test is the timeliness of the request for substitute counsel. Here, there's no dispute that Ms. Leslie's request for substitute counsel was timely. She requested substitute counsel more than a month before the scheduled trial date. The second prong of Bergerud's test is the adequacy of the court's inquiry. Again, here, there's no dispute that the court failed to inquire, and that's per se inadequate. The third prong of the test stated in People v. Bergerud is whether or not the attorney-client conflict resulted in a total communication breakdown or otherwise prevented an adequate or complete defense. Under this prong, there's several reasons that the record demonstrates that Ms. Leslie had good cause for her request for substitute counsel. First, a total communication breakdown is evidenced by beginning with the fact that counsel below, the ADC, didn't file any pretrial motions on Ms. Leslie's behalf. Despite that, counsel didn't inform Ms. Leslie that pretrial motions hearing had been vacated. Ms. Leslie traveled from Denver to Sulphur Springs and back for a non-hearing. The next court appearance, Ms. Leslie does fail to appear on June 12, 2008. She's picked up on a warrant 4 days later and sits in the Grand County Jail from June 16th until July 1st. The next court appearance on the record, counsel makes a record that he's had no contact with his client, but that he's given the client clear instructions to plead guilty and that the upcoming trial date interferes with his vacation plans. Almost immediately following this, Ms. Leslie files her letter with the court requesting substitute counsel. The reasons she gives in the letter are, counsel doesn't know my name and hasn't done any work on my behalf. There's a hearing on July 7, 2008, at which counsel, the ADC, is eventually discharged. The only record that the ADC makes at that hearing is that he thought he reached a plea disposition with the prosecutor to which Ms. Leslie would be amenable. There's a short recess. Then they come back on the record. The court asks Ms. Leslie whether she wishes to plead guilty. The prosecutor says, and Ms. Leslie says, not at this time. The prosecutor makes a record at that point saying he believes that they have reached a plea disposition, but he's concerned about the voluntariness of Ms. Leslie's statements, whether she can enter a plea voluntarily at that time. At this point, that record alone demonstrates that we have a breakdown in communication between counsel and Ms. Leslie here. Further,
well, counsel, let me ask you about the second part of the four-part test, the adequacy of the inquiry. The people point to the case of People v. Kelling and argue that despite the fact that the inquiry, at least initially, may not have been adequate, when you take a look at the communications that were sent informally by a letter and by communication of defense counsel to the court about communication problems, that is sufficient. What's wrong with that argument?
Referring to the defendant's own communications with the court?
Well, the written part that I think you referred to earlier, and also the defense counsel had told the court that he had made numerous attempts to reach the defendant and had not been successful, which the court took to mean, or at least the people represent, that was taken to mean that there was a communication problem.
Yes, Judge Ramon, and I think, Judge Ramon, that your question goes actually to the fourth part of the People v. Bergerud inquiry, in which the court is looking at whether or not the defendant unreasonably and substantially contributed to the communication breakdown. And what counsel below, the ADC, who is eventually discharged, the record he makes at that hearing on June 12, 2008, is a record of attempts at communication that he made with Ms. Leslie. It's notable that record only comes into play because she's not at that hearing. She's then, on 4 days later, taken into custody in Grand County, counsel has every opportunity to speak with his client, them, and remedy any communication breakdown that maybe that is occurring at that point. He doesn't do so. The next court appearance, he appears and says, I've had no contact with my client, but I'm instructing her to plead guilty. More to that point, the record that counsel makes at that hearing on June 12, 2008 doesn't state reasons why he and Ms. Leslie have failed to communicate. It does state that there's one or two missed appointments and that he's attempted to call her a few times. On that record, we don't know what exactly is going on in terms of the why the communication is breaking down. Certainly, it doesn't seem chargeable to the defendant on that record.
In the Killing case, another division of the court had stated that a defendant that has otherwise placed in the record his or her reasons for dissatisfaction with counsel, that can be sufficient. And the people are making the argument that that's what we have here, and that's what I would like you to address.
Well, and the defendant and Ms. Leslie did place in the record her reasons for dissatisfaction with counsel in the sense that she said that counsel hadn't done any work on her behalf, hadn't filed any. There's another letter other than the one that you're referring to in which Ms. Leslie states that he hasn't filed any motions in her behalf, doesn't know her name. I mean, she is placing in the record, at least under this test, that she believes a communication breakdown has occurred. Now, what the defense attorney placed in the record, making the record on June 12, 2008, was simply his record of the breakdown in communication between Ms. Leslie and counsel.
Isn't that the people's point, that she did put in the record that there was a communication problem and that the court had enough information in front of it to make that determination, regardless of holding a hearing on the matter?
No, I would not agree with that. I believe that the court, it is undisputed, it did not do an inquiry into what the communication breakdown was. And when you're talking about a communication breakdown, as United States v. Law, the Tenth Circuit case states, there's no precise definition for what that means. Ms. Leslie states that counsel's had no contact with me, counsel doesn't know my name, hasn't done work on my behalf. At that point, it was the court's duty to inquire based on, there's other information on this record after counsel's discharge, that additional reasons that Ms. Leslie had, demonstrating that her request had good cause underlying it, and she would have been able to articulate those reasons if the court had been willing to inquire at the hearing.
Mr. Hardy, if the court had inquired and satisfied itself that there wasn't a complete breakdown in communications and there was no actual conflict between counsel and the defendant, would that rise to structural error in your view?
I'm sorry, I just want to make sure I have your question right, Judge Graham. Had the court inquired and found that there had been no breakdown in communication?
What kind of error does that present, if any?
Well, I mean, under that circumstance, which of course isn't the circumstance we have here, but under that circumstance, if the court had made findings that there was no breakdown in communication, then we would be reviewing that court's findings on appeal, of course. At that point, the court at least would have had a basis for its denial of substitute counsel and Ms. Leslie's request at that point.
So should we remand it for findings?
That is obviously a possible remedy that this court could resolve to make here. Ms. Leslie's position is certainly that the record here demonstrates that there was good cause for her request. However, if the court chooses to remand, if the court finds that this record isn't sufficient to determine whether or not there was good cause for Ms. Leslie's request, then we would contend that Ms. Leslie would contend that the court should direct the court below to make a determination only on the good cause question and not the separate inquiry as to whether there was actually a voluntary, knowing, and intelligent waiver here. But again, we don't believe that this record, it's necessary to send it down for remand. We believe this record actually demonstrates that Ms. Leslie had any cause for her request. And there are other good reasons beyond that, actually, just under the Bergeron test demonstrating good cause. remanding this case in this situation where the trial court completely failed to do an inquiry, some degree takes the teeth out of the rule that the court is obligated to do that contemporaneous hearing. I mean, under these circumstances, the purpose for that rule is so you can settle that question not 2.5 years later at the time. And if, in fact, there is good cause at the time, appoint counsel so you don't end up in a situation where you have potential structural error because the defendant with an impermissible choice has decided to take the lesser of two evils going pro se. I think I've addressed to some extent the fourth prong of the Bergeron test, the contribution to the defendant's contribution to the communication breakdown. I'd just like to stress that test is whether or not the defendant made a substantial and unreasonable contribution to that communication breakdown. It's a high bar the Supreme Court sets there. That's also supposed to be viewed through the prism of whether or not the client's conduct was for the purpose of trial delay. And here we have no record that necessitates trying to delay the trial. In fact, quite the contrary. After counsel is discharged in this case, Ms. Leslie sends another letter to the court moving to dismiss because she wants counsel and hasn't been provided it, but also requesting an earlier trial date, which is in fact affected on the record. So clearly any contribution that Ms. Leslie may have had to a breakdown in communication here was not for the purpose of trial delay. She wanted a quicker trial. I believe I've also touched on, thanks to your question, Judge Graham, the remedy issue. If the court doesn't have further questions at this time, I'd just like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right, Mr. Hardy, you have about 3 minutes and 45 seconds.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I'm Jennifer Berman, registration number 35882, and I represent the people in this matter. We're all in agreement here that the trial court did not engage the defendant in an inquiry when the defendant stated, "I have a bad lawyer that don't even know my name or anything about me," which is what she stated. We're all in agreement on that fact. But as Judge Ramon pointed out, under the Kelling case, that is not reversible error where the defendant otherwise makes known the reasons for which she is dissatisfied with counsel, and the defendant did that here. She indicated that there were communication problems between her and her appointed counsel, and appointed counsel had made a record on that as well.
How specific does the inquiry have to be?
That's a good question. I don't know. It has to be an inquiry.
Oh, when I read the Kelling case, it looked like there was a lot more information provided to the court in the written communication than what the judge was provided with here.
Right, but there was other parts of the record in which the judge had already been made aware of a communication problem between the defendant and counsel. So even though the defendant's own letter to the court was that I have a bad attorney, he doesn't know my name, he doesn't know anything about me, the court was already made aware that there were these communication problems between her and defense counsel and that they hadn't been able to communicate very much.
Ms. Berman, I'm having trouble understanding how the defendant was able to make an adequate record regarding whatever she wanted to say when the trial court judge kept cutting her off and not permitting her to finish her sentences and threatened to send her for a competency evaluation.
Well, again, the trial court didn't inquire. We're all in agreement on that. And to the extent that the defendant tried to make more of a record, the court told her, I'm going to give you the choice between appointed counsel or going pro se. And I believe that it's at that point that when he tried to engage her in the Arguello advisement to discuss the dangers and disadvantages of going pro se, that she kept interrupting him when the trial court would ask, do you understand your right to counsel? And she would say, no, I don't understand it. What don't you understand about it? I don't understand it because I have a bad attorney. And I think at that point, the trial court was getting frustrated with her and perhaps shouldn't have, but felt that she was not cooperating with that advisement.
But aren't there two separate waiver of counsel arguments in front of us? One, as it relates to the Arguello advisement, and two, as it relates to substitution of counsel. And you seem to be addressing the Arguello advisement, but you haven't really dealt with the substitution of counsel argument.
Right. And there are the two separate inquiries. I believe that the trial court's comments to her were, my recollection of the record is that those comments to her were made when it was trying to advise her of her right to proceed through self-representation. So going back to the right to substitute counsel, the defendant made the court aware of the fact that she didn't believe there was good communication between her and counsel, and she did not present good cause for substitution of counsel here because the record itself shows that, first of all, she was the main cause of the lack of communication between her and counsel. She did substantially and unreasonably contribute to any communication problems they had.
Well, to the extent that the defendant wanted to respond to that or make some comment to the contrary that would allow the trial court to make adequate findings, the trial court didn't allow her to do so, did it?
No, I'm not basically shoved that she wanted to.
Basically shoved this down the defendant's throat. Isn't that what happened?
The trial court gave her the choice between continuing with counsel and going pro se. Based on the record as a whole, that was a permissible choice, because the defendant's contention that there was a breakdown in communication, a complete breakdown in communication between her and counsel, is refuted by the record itself. Because first of all, the defendant created any communication problems between her and counsel. Twice counsel tried to set up scheduled hearings with her in Denver where she lived, and she failed to appear at those. He claimed he sent her at least two letters and never received responses. He tried to call her and never received any responses from her.
Ms. Berman, can any problem with this be resolved by remanding for findings?
If you believe that this record is insufficient to determine yourselves whether the defendant has shown good cause, then yes, you can remand for a hearing on that issue.
Did the Bougereau decision direct that a violation of the Sixth Amendment would be a structural error and that it wouldn't be appropriate to remand for findings, but rather would warrant a new trial?
No, the Bougereau decision itself, in fact, did remand for further findings on two of the issues, whether the defendant's right to testify had been violated and also whether her, not her right to plead guilty, I apologize, I can't recall the third one. It did remand for a hearing on that issue. So it did not find that it was structural error warranting reversal.
Supreme Court also say that, quote, any violation of his Sixth Amendment rights would result in a complete denial of his right to counsel. And then didn't that,
right,
didn't they go on to find that that would constitute structural error warranting a new trial?
Correct, but that's the determination. The violation of the Sixth Amendment rights is whether the defendant did in fact have good cause for seeking substitute counsel, and that's what needs to be determined either here by this panel or, if need be, on remand by the trial court at a hearing. So whether or not there was a Sixth Amendment violation can only be determined by a determination of whether or not the defendant has in fact shown good cause for substitution of counsel. As to the defendant's express waiver of counsel, she was given a thorough Arguello advisement. She expressly waived thereafter, and therefore it was an effective waiver of counsel. So if the court has no questions on that issue or on the substitution of counsel issue.
Can I ask you a quick question about the Arguello advisement?
Yes.
Is the waiver valid when it's embedded in threats to send the defendant to a psychiatric evaluation in Pueblo, and the trial court is telling the defendant that headed up to here and is and just about ready to lose it with her. Does that go anywhere toward the validity of the waiver in that context?
I don't believe it does on this record. Again, the trial court was frustrated, and it would have been a better practice not to show that frustration. But the trial court did engage the defendant in very thorough Arguello advisement, advising her of the nature of the charges, the possible penalties, and the dangers of disadvantages of proceeding through self-representation. And the record shows that she understood those and voluntarily decided to represent herself thereafter. Thank you. If the court has any more questions, I would ask that you affirm the convictions.
Mr. Hardy?
As to People v. Kellen, I believe the rule that Judge Roman was referring to in that case is that if the defendant otherwise voices her reasons for dissatisfaction with counsel on the record, then reversal is not always required. In fact, actually what happened in People v. Kellen was it was remanded down for further findings. And Beaudrillard actually expounds on what's discussed in People v. Kellen, adding actually a fourth factor onto the test that up till Beaudrillard had been Colorado law. That fourth factor is the client's contribution, unreasonable or substantial contribution, to the attorney-client breakdown in communication. And again, that's viewed through the prism of whether or not the client's conduct is for the purpose of trial delay, which we don't have here. As to the question about the Arguello advisement, Ms. Leslie's position is clearly that it's not an appropriate Arguello advisement under the threat of the court losing its temper and sending her for a psychiatric exam if the court doesn't get the answers to the questions that it's asking. And in fact, what you see in the advisement here on the record is that once the court makes that threat, Ms. Leslie begins complying and giving all the correct answers. Arguello itself provides that an advisement which consists of pro forma questions and pro forma answers, even though they're from the judge's handbook as provided in Arguello, is not a sufficient advisement. And beyond that, the advisement itself is not the only thing you look at in the context of waiver here. You have to look at the totality of circumstances. Now, a by-the-book advisement is a strong circumstance. Now, I don't think we have a by-the-book advisement here with these circumstances of compulsion that are going on. But even so, there's no unequivocal statement or conduct on Ms. Leslie's part at any time that she wants to represent herself. In fact, throughout trial, between trial and the substitution of counsel hearing, Ms. Leslie is telling the court that she wants counsel. And as to the waiver question, I believe Beaudrillard and under Beaudrillard that Ms. Leslie has demonstrated through the record, and the court can consider everything on the record, not just what took place on that hearing, where I would point out the court never actually made an express finding of a waiver, of a voluntary, knowing, and intelligent waiver at that hearing. But the court can look at everything in the record, and looking at the record as a whole, under Beaudrillard, believe good cause is demonstrated for Ms. Leslie's request. But even so, if the court believes remand is necessary on that question, as to the waiver, as to the second question, the waiver of counsel, this court should follow its previous opinions in Rawson, Campbell, People v. Stanley. Those cases, very similar to this one, where the client, where there's either a completely insufficient inquiry, or like this one, no inquiry at all into the client's reasons for requesting new counsel, this court found that to be reversible error. And then finally, as to counsel's point about the court being frustrated during the Arguello advisement, People v. Campbell, which is 58 P3rd 1148, very clearly says that the court's frustration with the defendant is not relevant to the inquiry. Unless the court has any other questions, I'll rest on that. Ms. Leslie requests that you reverse her convictions and remand the case for a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hardy. Thank you again, Ms. Berman. Thanks to both counsel for your excellent presentations this afternoon. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.